Good morning, everyone in the room, at home, and at their own computers by watching us. It will be another fun day. Very interesting topics. We start off with agenda paper six, pension benefits that depend on asset returns, and I hand over to Filippo.
Thank you, Andreas. Good morning, everybody. The objective of this session is to ask the board for a decision on the direction of the research pension project on pension benefits that depend on asset returns. The board started the research project in 2014. At the time, it was observed that the entities were moving away from traditional terms associated with defined benefit plans and were replacing these plans with so-called hybrid plans. Plans with benefits that depend on the returns of a specified pool of assets are one type of these hybrid plans. Following the 2015 agenda consultation, the board decided not to add a broad scope project on post-employment benefits. The board added to its research pipeline a project to assess the feasibility of developing a narrow scope amendment on the measurement of the defined benefit obligation for this type of benefits, and also to assess whether this type of benefit was widespread enough to justify standard setting. We have completed the research, and at this session, the staff recommends that the board develops a narrow scope amendment to IAS 19, introducing what we call the capped approach. Applying the capped approach, an entity would use the discount rate in IAS 19 to make an estimate of the ultimate cost to provide this type of benefits when the discount rate in IAS 19 is lower than the expected return rate on the reference assets. The entity would then apply all the other requirements in IAS 19. If the board does not support the recommendation to develop a narrow scope amendment to IAS 19, then the staff suggests that the board stops the project and consider any further work as the outcome in the context of the third agenda consultation. The consultation document for the third agenda consultation includes a potential project on hybrid plans, and this project would presumably include also this type of benefits. The questions for the board are on page 19 of agenda paper six. With that, I leave the floor to the board members.
Okay. So board members, floor is open. Any comments? Bertrand.
Thank you. Thank you to the staff for the analysis and the papers and the discussions we had on it. The focus of the paper is on the net pension liability, which I totally understand the reason why, and I perfectly appreciate that there is an accounting mismatch. I'm not so disputing that at all. My focus would be more on the gross pension liability than on the net pension liability. Probably this is one of the most important informations for those other users of the financial statements who are the employees of the company, who are the beneficiaries of the pension plans of the company. The defined benefit obligation, the obligations of the company, actually, they represent, most importantly, the social rights of the employees and of the beneficiaries. For me, where I am now, I think the paper has not provided me sufficient evidence that we should set an exception to the general DBO measurement requirements in IAS 19. Throughout the literature, throughout the standards, the DBO is systematically, constantly measured the exact same way. And so I'm wondering whether really this issue merits a different measurement or accounting treatment. I would have eventually, even though I totally understand that there might be challenges for that, but I would have eventually more accepted an alignment on the value of the asset onto the measurements of the DBO. And maybe a way would have been to expand the scope, the current scope of paragraph 115 in RS19 potentially. So I perfectly appreciate that it wouldn't apply there, but we could have considered this. I'm a bit reluctant, to say the least, on proceeding with the proposal that you have set, and I would have probably I will be more in the camp of not doing anything in this regard, as I think the benefits are not that. I appreciate there are benefits, but I think they do not, for me, outweigh the cost of departing from a general measurement of the DBO in our estimate.
Thank you. Harry?
I think sentiment's pretty close to what Bertrand was just expressing. I think the staff, it's right to call the question at this point in time, which is what you're doing, saying either continue along or let's stop this and throw it into the bigger pool of agenda consultation. And I also agree that there are some very real challenges with applying existing IS-19 to hybrid plans. The issue that's been selected, low those many years ago, for the focus of this project is a very specific subset of the many questions that come up with hybrids. And while I can see for plans that have a characteristic of part of the benefit, it's not the whole, because as you illustrate very often, the at least notional principal amount is a proportion of salary. So, there's a tie back to salary as well. That when there is part of the benefit promised depends on return on a specific pool of assets, it feels like there's some degree of mismatch here. But there are also, Filippo, as you identify in the paper, if it were just a straightforward proportion of salary contributed to a plan and invested, that would be a DC plan. We're only talking about this because there are other features that flip it into a DB plan, like, for example, the promise of a minimum return guarantee. So I comment expansively about that stuff to say, that's it. The guarantee is, to me, an example of another and potentially more pressing issue in the area of hybrids. And I think we have to remember that we aren't solving all the questions about hybrids. This proposal is just going in and looking at a slice of them. And I'm a bit concerned that's the slice that particularly offends accountants, as opposed to, really impacts on usefulness of information. So, I step back and where I start joining up with Bertrand is I think the hurdle should be pretty high for us to create a further exception to an already complex standard that has a lot of moving parts. There's a known consequence from the proposed approach in here, and I'm dealing with the approach first, which is that it systematically understates the gross DBO. The defined benefit obligation before you discount it, because you may expect that the returns will be 5%, and therefore you expect the liability to the gross liability to grow at 5%, but if the discount rate is 2.5%, you would only measure the gross liability using the 2.5%, which is why I say there'd be a deliberate understatement. And then when I get back to the question of how widespread is the problem and is it so overwhelming that it justifies going back and crosses that high hurdle of a further exception to an already complex standard, I think the best I could say is that the evidence is inconclusive. That is not a criticism of the staff research, because I think you have beaten all the bushes to try and find all the information available. And when I look at the material in this paper, there's some inferences we can draw about the prevalence, the increasing prevalence of hybrid plans, but that doesn't give us direct evidence about the prevalence of this issue. And the quantitative information in here is very mixed, you know, about how much do we know. So I come back to high hurdle, do we, you know, yes. Do we have overwhelming evidence that it's important? No. Does it fix all the problems with this category of plans? No. So I'd say I agree with you calling the question at this point. I just would prefer the other alternative of saying, let's not pursue this and put, you know, put the concerns about hybrid into the broader consideration of agenda consultation. But I think, you know, good work, good analysis. If the board as a whole wants to go ahead with this, I have flagged a couple of other issues that I think we'd have to address in the course of this, which I think would further complicate the exception, but I'm not going to go into those now. I'll raise them or send them offline.
I think before I continue with Rika, I think you raise very, very good points, Mary. The one bit that I would just throw into the discussion at this stage is, if we were to draw the conclusion that we should rather stop this project for all the reasons that you just alluded to, and say that we will reconsider this when we come to devising our work plan for the next 5 years, what would we do if the feedback by stakeholders was limited as to should we do something in pension accounting, knowing that our standard, existing standard, creates problems with a vast contingent of pension plans?
Assuming that you directed that at me and you want me to respond.
Well, I mean, it's just for general consideration, I think, because I think that plays a role here.
Yeah.
I hear you that if we solved this issue, it would be a very tiny issue and it would come at a very high price because it wouldn't be the brightest conceptual answer, to be very polite. But to just stay silent and say we have a standard that's 35 years old, was developed with a completely different environment at that time. Pension plans have moved. DB has almost stopped in many parts of the world. DC seems to be the favor and hybrid plans. And hybrid plans is something that our standard is not really equipped to provide a robust answer with. Yet, the majority of our stakeholders do not think that we should engage in standard setup. What do we do then? Because I think that there is a problem here. And even if stakeholders don't list that problem as being the highest for us to consider, do we just still say we pause on this and leave it hanging?
Can I comment on the agenda consultation point?
You can, sure.
For me, I think the agenda consultation is a really useful way for us to get a sort of read of the room in a global sense. You know, what are our stakeholders thinking? What's front of their mind? But ultimately, we have to make decisions and we need to think about what we think is important as well. So I don't think it's sort of a popularity contest. Like, you know, it's not strictly. We're not counting votes.
Mm.
We need to take seriously what they say.
Mm.
But, you know, if we look at our book and say, actually, we think there's a really big issue here as well, I think we probably have the right, at least, to consider how we think about that.
Yeah.
That would be my
reaction. That's fair enough. Sorry, Mary, you want?
No, on the question that you just posed, my gut reaction to that is, if we go about it in a way that's not the way we go about it normally and say we have We, and it's not just us, it's also our stakeholders, have X amount of time to devote to a project related to some of the many questions around hybrids. Is this the highest priority? My gut is that a better priority would be addressing, let's say, the accounting for guarantees in those contexts, and that we would address more problems across more plans. So if we were approaching it from a we can spend X on pensions, I don't think this would be highest and best use. I think we put it onto the agenda in part because we thought there was a quick win that could basically paddle along rather like a little more than an AIP, maybe a narrow scope amendment. And the fact that it's a complex issue and we've had to pick it up and put it down means that it's already cost way more than we thought it would.
Mm-hmm.
So to your point, yes, I know IS-19 is creaking when it comes to applying it to today's mix of pension plans, but I'm not sure that this is the highest priority problem.
Okay. Thank you. Rita.
Thank you. With the veteran and Mary about how to handle this project going forward. I think the first of all, thank you very much for staff to prepare and analyze this specific pension benefit plan. I think I definitely agree that this is a most elegant way to address the issue, as if we only focus on this particular type of pension benefit. So I truly appreciate staff's work to bring us to today's discussion. But at the same time, I think this exemption is kind of the small exemption, you might say, but still, this exemption will affect the general IS-19 requirement to estimate the cash flow to determine the DBO, I think, because when I look at paragraph 57, A and 1, it talks about how to estimate the ultimate cost to the entity of the pension benefit, and then this requires an entity to determine how much benefit is attributable to the current and prior periods, and to make estimates, actuary assumption, and financial variability, such as future increase in salaries and medical costs that will affect the cost of the benefit. So it's talking about kind of the actuary assumptions and financial variability. It's related to the salary and the medical cost will affect the cost of the benefit. It's not referring to the variability of the reference asset. So I think I understand that the staff doesn't touch this, would not touch this paragraph directly, but if we define this particular pension benefit, we will borrow the word from the paragraph 57A1 about the ultimate cost. So I'm just wondering that kind of the I just wondering the consequence of using that word ultimate cost from paragraph 57, and what the consequence of using that critical word in IS-19. So, and I also think the adjustment staff has already identified on this paper is undefined in the IS-19 framework at this moment. So we need to look into further about the nature and feature of the adjustment to determine how to account for that point. And so I think technically, we still need to continue discussing about how to account for this particular type of pension plan. And then when I consider the scope of this project, I think, yes, it's kind of the part of hybrid pension benefit. And then as I agree with Mary's point that now the hybrid plans becomes more prominent than before, but I don't think this type of plan had increased over time since we started discussing about this particular project. I think existing jurisdiction has already their own pension benefit plan, and that's a so-called hybrid plan. And if they already have their particular plan in their jurisdiction, I don't think they start moving to use this targeted benefit plan in the future. So I think this type of plan will continue existing But I don't think the prominence of this type of plan will increase in the future. So I feel like the question is the scope is pervasive for us to address the standard setting project if we only focus on the targeted benefit plan is my big question at this moment.
Thank you, Rika.
So first of all, I'd like to start to thank the staff for a very good paper because I think it sets out very clearly the issues and it is stimulated debate, which I think is very obvious. I'll be brief beyond that because, like others, I'm also anxious about developing this route here. And it's the elements that trip this from defined contribution and defined benefit. You know, we have the example of a guaranteed return here. We spent years in another project looking about how to deal with guarantees. And all of a sudden we're going to do a quick fix here. So I would prefer a more holistic approach if we choose to go down that route in terms of looking at it in the round of the agenda consultation than pursuing this today.
Very clear. Thank you. Tom?
Yeah, so it's interesting listening to this one. I want to just do a little bit of history, though. The staff are doing this because the board, a prior version of the board with different views, thought that this was a problem. And the board was fully aware, and I'll use actually for expositional, underline expositional, it would apply to some other ones as well. I'm going to just use the minimum guarantee being attached to something that otherwise looks pretty much like defined contribution, whether it's at an individual level or in some kind of a group setting. So we thought this was a problem because fundamentally in a defined contribution, what the plan participants get are the assets. And what the entity owes is essentially the assets. The entity could maintain possession of the contributions and invest it, but fundamentally all the people get are the assets. The problem arises because in 19 it says everything that's not a pure, plain, vanilla defined contribution becomes a defined benefit, and therefore we take the amount that's owed, the assets, we project it forward at one rate, we bring it back at a different rate, and voila, the liability is now greater than the assets. But what they owe is the assets at the time. And next year they'll owe the assets at the time. It doesn't matter, by the way, whether it's a notional set of assets. It could be the S&P 500 that is owed. You can track that. You know exactly what you owe, whether it's there or not. So the board thought that we should fix this mismatch, what is called the mismatch problem. The board also said it didn't want to touch the guarantee. So I know what kind of Mary said, but that's what the board said, is we don't want to touch too complicated. You know, we want to keep it simple. And one of the things I do want to highlight here, and then we told the staff, go and solve the problem for the mismatch. And I want to really commend the staff. This is an absolute solid solution to what the then board asked them to do. It works perfectly. It doesn't touch the discount rate. It doesn't overstate the liability. It also doesn't overstate the service cost or service cost, so it doesn't understate income, and it doesn't overstate interest. So if you do it times interest earned, you're losing on both sides without the correction. Like your numerator shrinks and your denominator rises. So I just wanted to come back to why we asked the staff to do this. They come back with a perfect solution. If you look through the math on the spreadsheets, it's great. In fact, and there's no plugs. Almost every number can be calculated directly, so we know what the adjustment is. And we've done a lot of work, and if we go forward, all we really have to do is choose where to put the adjustment. We know what it looks like, we know how to calculate it, and does it go in profit or loss or OCI? And I actually don't think that would be that difficult. So I want to really commend staff for doing exactly what the then board asked them to do. I'm sympathetic to some of the arguments raised, but I want to highlight these are criticisms of the then board's decision, not what the staff have done. Essentially, they're saying you should never have given the staff these marching orders. We don't want to deal with it this way. I note that the then board wasn't alone. EFRAG put out a discussion paper, so it's other people thought this was a problem. And there are quite a bit of hybrid plans with these things. So, and I voted for it too, and I don't know what the vote was. I didn't go back and look up who's changed or hasn't changed. But I do want to highlight just what a great job staff did, and that fundamentally this is a criticism of the then board decision. So then do we go forward with the partial solution, which I think would work for the partial? And I know some of the arguments, and even I will go to the what we get is something that's not representationally faithful. But when we dropped the guarantee, we lost some representational faithfulness. That should, if we had accounted for the guarantee, we would have increased the liability. In this case, because if we do this matching thing, we overstate the liability. I have no idea. They're different directions. I have no idea if they offset. I assume they probably typically don't. I don't particularly like that as an argument for doing nothing, that we have two offsetting errors that we hope cancel. So I don't know quite where people want to go with this, and I don't know about whether it is worth it. And I can see the arguments now why we should not have done that. So if when we do vote, one thing I would strongly recommend, because I think the solution is so good, that we do a really nice paper of saying, we were told to do this, here is the solution for posterity. If a future board goes back to the thinking of the then board, if we decide to reject this, that solution can just be pulled off the rack, because I don't see anything wrong with the solution that we got to what the board asked these people to do. So I am a little bit frustrated, though, that we have asked people to do something and then said, just kidding, a little bit, even for good reasons. Even though I think the reasons are legitimate and we have new board members and so on. But I just wanted to really highlight the quality work the staff did with the mandate that they were given.
Thanks, Tom. Let's hear from Tadeo.
Thank you, Andreas, and thank you, the staff, for preparing the papers, the examples. And thanks for Tom providing this, all this history. I think that's quite important to understand where we are. And I just reflect to myself here whether I should think differently the way that I was prepared to say some words here, but I don't think it does. First, I think that the topic should be addressed. And the IS-19 may not provide the answer preparers and users seem to be expected. But as Mary said, and Tom just confirmed, the issue was selected some years ago. I think there are more issues. When I start understanding the issue, it seems to be part of a major issue that, let's call it here, some may not agree, but as the hybrid plans, I mean, that we have many, it's just a kind of, as using the, stalling the words from Mary, a subset of this one. And I think that the point is, it makes more sense. And stalling another word from Mary, you said quick win. And going back to the point of Tom, I mean, that it could be a quick win. I think that the staff did the job, the right job, tried to find a solution. But when we start making questions about something that is slightly different from the fact pattern developed for this solution, I think that we might have a problem, because there are more situations within this issue. And then it becomes more complicated. And I just thought to myself, it makes more sense if we just go for a single project, probably a major one, but dealing with all issues related to this new way of operating pension benefits, especially through the hybrid plan. Therefore, my position in relation to the questions posed by the staff is that we shouldn't go for this narrow scope amendment. We should treat this within a major project, considering the third agenda consultation. Thank you.
Thanks, Tadeo. Jincha.
Thank you. Yeah, listening to the discussion, I think it's very, very tricky, because actually when I read the paper, and actually I calculate all the numbers again, look at whether the capture approach work or not. Actually, it works. Actually, as Tom said, I think I really appreciate Philip and the team, to develop a solution to resolve that particular issue. And also, I agree with what Tom said that the scope was decided by the board. Narrow scope, try to fix that issue, and rather than to address broader issue. And it's a result of the 2015 agenda consultation. So maybe the board needs to do something to particularly to address this specific issue. So, but after calculating all those numbers, actually I come back, what's the objective we're going to do in relation to the pension plan or pension accounting? I think the main objective, we try to faithfully represent the pension obligation those companies have, and try to avoid some kind of distorting or, mispresenting because of accounting treatment. So in this regard, I think captured approach actually reflects this kind of objective, because without this approach in place, definitely there is inconsistency between the estimated amount of the pension benefit and the discount rate. So that means in some cases, particularly IFRS 19 discount rate lower than the expected return of those, related expected return rate on the reference assets, the liability will be overstated. So in this regard, I think on this specific scope, narrow scope, I think the approach actually consistent with what we are going to achieve. So, but obviously there are broader issues. And I also heard something, for example, guarantee issues, how to measure it, how to consider in this model, something like that. Maybe stakeholder will raise this issue. But I'm thinking about a practical solution, because we have done a lot of work, research to develop this solution and spend a lot of resources. And I know that some stakeholders also following our project closely, they also spend a lot of time and resources on this project. If we stop here and waiting for third agenda consultation, it may be 5 years later or even more, we will pick up again. So we will start again and consult the stakeholders' views again, because we always think, one of the factors we're thinking about is about resources constraint from board perspective, also from stakeholder perspective. So from because we also talk about whether this issue pervasive or enough or something like that. I really appreciate actually staff did a lot of work, but it's very difficult to get feedback on this specific issue, so why we don't approach a little bit further, maybe, and then develop this solution to seek feedback from stakeholders, particularly those stakeholders has been following this project closely. And let us where that this kind of situation is pervasive or not, whether this work, because this is just a narrow scope amendment, and that our captured approach work or not. I think it will not cost too much to stakeholders, resources and time, particularly those stakeholders has been following our proposal very closely. So my personal view is that we have done a lot of work here. If we stop, we waste a lot of resources time. Can we try it and then get some feedback from stakeholders? It's not too late. If the stakeholders say, don't do that, we can still stop project. But at least we can get feedback from stakeholders to test whether this approach works or not. So this is my view. Yeah, whether we can give a chance, give opportunity to try.
Thank you, Chin Chan. Bruce?
Thanks very much. I'm quite in kind of a foot in both camps on this thing. And I mean, to start off with, I I would like to echo what everybody said about the staff paper and especially the illustrative example. As somebody who hasn't worked hugely with these in many years, that example really kind of helped in terms of understanding the complexities of what's happening. I mean, I guess when I take a look at this, the challenge to me is that when I go through the paper and look at everything, much like Tom said, I mean, this makes sense. I mean, from reading it, I think when I look at it and say, will financial reporting be better afterwards, my interpretation was I think it's an improvement to financial reporting, which means the question has to be, well, why wouldn't we look at it now? I hear what everybody's saying around the different options, and I guess in my mind, I'm trying to work out why we're seeing this as a binary choice. I don't believe that the approval or non-approval of doing something here means we can't take it on ICE 19 and the agenda consultation. So I get a bit concerned that we're looking at this as, well, we should do one or the other. I mean, my view is much like Sue said, we've got the right to do that, and I would always suggest we should look at the standard. It is an old standard. It's outdated. I think we should do that regardless of what we decide today. So I don't see these as a binary choice as to do one or the other. And how this rolls up into it, I'm not going to anticipate either, because that will be a bigger project and we need to determine what that's going to be, so I'm not too worried about that. I guess the other thing is that we've got an identified problem and we've found a narrow solution to it. And it's not the first time we've picked up a narrow scope amendment to a standard which has a myriad of problems, but we've decided just to fix one. There's precedent for that over many years. So I'm not concerned that, and I know I appreciate there are a lot of problems with hybrids, there are a lot of problems with various types of schemes, but there are many standards that have got a lot of problems and we've picked up just one element of those. Brilliant. So it's one of those days. So I'm not too concerned about kind of how we go from that point of view. I think it's more to me around, do we think this narrow scope amendment improves what we currently have in ICE 19? I guess being in two camps made things a bit difficult. I'm glad I went after Jin Chao, because I'm kind of starting to feel a bit like he does. I mean, I guess we're sitting here. Oh, thanks, okay. I guess we're sitting here trying to decide what we think the right answer is, and maybe this is an issue where we can put it out and say, look, is there an opportunity to get feedback from people? We've got our views in terms of what we got, but if this thing went out, we develop a narrow scope amendment, we put this out there as an exposure draft. If the overwhelming response comes back and says exactly what we've heard and saying, this is the worst thing for you guys to do, well, we've got the right not to do it then. That's the intention of an exposure draft, why we don't go straight to standards. So we've got a mechanism that allows us to see whether this is the right way for us to pursue this. And I just feel that given there's such mixed views, and I guess maybe when we get to the vote they're not mixed views, which will be easier, but if there are very mixed views, to me, I feel that when things are so divided, it makes more sense for us to go wider, ask people what they think, and maybe the way to do that is to put this out to exposure and see what the feedback is from constituents. So, yeah, I mean, I do appreciate that, yeah, there are a lot of things we could fix in ICE 19, but I don't see these as one or the other. So, yeah. I wish I had an answer to it, but...
Okay, thank you, Bruce. Sue.
I've also been sort of struggling and going backwards and forwards in terms of what I think on this issue, trying to balance some of the same considerations that others have been talking about. But I think on balance, I don't think we should do this at the moment. And my sort of considerations are sort of taking into account some of the things that Bruce has just talked about, but sort of coming out on the other side, because we have... And this, is, of course, not at all a question about whether the staff have done the right thing or the right job, or whether the old board, you know, made the right decisions or not. I think we've got a responsibility on an ongoing basis to be grown up enough to keep assessing, are we doing the right thing? Are these the right cost-benefit considerations? And to be brave enough sometimes to say, actually, we've changed our mind. I think the important thing for me is that we have spent quite a bit of time on this. And certainly the national standard setters have spent quite a bit of time on this. But if we keep going, we're going to ask a lot of other people now to spend a lot of time. And many of us are sort of wondering if it's a good use of time or not. And we're going to spend a lot more time, because to get from here, to get a document out the door, to get comments, is not a small amount of work for us and for our stakeholders. And so I think we have to be brave sometimes and stop and say, actually, you know, is it right to continue, even though there is quite a sunk cost? And for me, I think the risk with narrow scope amendments is people tend to, you know, they've got better things to do than worry about accounting all day like we do. So they'll respond to what we put out, and that most people will look at it in a very specific way. They'll respond to the document they've got in front of them. And that encourages us to do narrow scope amendments. And for me, there's real opportunity costs with narrow scope amendments. One is, and we only have to think about our discussion about IAS 28 yesterday, what our standards can end up like when we do multiple projects with bits and pieces being attached, you know, and then what does an end product end up looking like? We have to be really careful with narrow scope amendments because you end up with weird looking standards afterwards. And also, I think there's a real opportunity cost when we do a narrow scope project, because I think the reality is it makes it less likely that we do the bigger project. So I'm not sure that it is necessarily the case that once we go down a path and we say, oh, we've spent all of this time on this now, let's just get it done, I think it reduces the likelihood that we would do a bigger project every time we decide to do a narrow scope project. So it's not to me as if by doing this we have no effect on the likelihood of doing a more comprehensive review of the standard. And so I think given some of the concerns raised, which I share about the complexity for investors as well of understanding this new sort of bespoke approach where you look at the undiscounted amount, it's quite a different way of thinking compared with anything else we've got in 19 at the moment. The fact that it is helping with hybrids, which we know are important, but a subset of hybrids, you know, I think on balance, I probably wouldn't support pursuing it at the moment.
Thank you. And
thanks, Andreas. I much prefer to follow Bruce and Jen Chow than Sue. My thinking was much more where Jen Chow and then Bruce was on this issue. And Sue's just given counter-arguments to a lot of that. So let me raise a couple of different things. I want to return to Andreas's point, which is, you know, if there is no big project from a gender consultation, would we then go with the narrow scope? And I think that's a question. I hear the things that people are talking about and different views being expressed, and we're going to vote on it. I just would like us to think, we're very close to looking at our agenda consultation materials and starting our discussions on priorities, so we should know what people are saying about IAS 19. We are going to vote today, and that is a decision. We could have the thought that we would, irrespective of today's decision, we would consider again whether we wanted to do a narrow scope after we've seen a gender consultation and made that decision, rather than before, because Sue has pointed out that making a decision to do a narrow scope can affect the decision on the bigger project. If the decision goes for no today, and then we have to consider in a gender consultation, I suppose I'm raising the question as to whether we would consider a narrow scope on IAS 19 if there is no big project after we do consider a gender consultation. So that's just something I'm raising at this point in the discussion. Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. Zach, please.
Thanks. So I'll just make unanimous the support for the work of the staff. It was incredibly helpful. I got to spend time playing in Excel, which is always a joy for me, and makes things quite clear. Sometimes in a way that just reading doesn't for me. I think where I come down to really rests with Rika's point, which is in prevalence and growth, which I think may be where the situation has changed over the last 7 years, is the prior board seems to have made a decision that although defined benefit plans were shrinking, there was a likelihood that these hybrid plans and particular plans that looked like this would be growing. And I think there's new evidence that that's not necessarily the case, or at the very least, there's not enough evidence that they are. And so for me, it would be appropriate to say we've sunk a lot of time in here, but does it make sense in the absence of that evidence to keep going? And I'm not sure it does. We may change our minds when the agenda consultation comes around. We could get a lot of feedback saying this is a really important area and you need to spend time. That feedback could guide us towards a more holistic solution, or it could guide us towards maintaining a narrow scope. But I think to vote to proceed with the narrow scope with a lack of clear evidence isn't an efficient allocation of time. So I would probably not be supportive of voting to proceed at this point, but do think the work has been exemplary.
Thank you, Zach. Before I give my views, I would give Neely an opportunity to share with us indicative feedback that the staff has received on the agenda consultation, noting that obviously we will have our full rediscussion about the consultation feedback in November and December. So this is just a snapshot, but I asked her whether she would be in a position to give us an indication as to what has been heard.
Sure, Andreas. And I'll share two data points, but before I do that, just to underscore what Sue had already said, that it's not a popularity contest, although what I'm going to share with you will make it sound like it is a popularity contest. but because right now we're still getting under all the reasons. So right now I just have numbers for you. But the first data point is in terms of doing a larger project on IS-19, Of the surveys and the comment letters that we received, more than half didn't even respond to anything related to IS-19. Of the ones that did respond, so about 80 or so that did respond, 35 said it was a low priority, 19 said it was a high priority. So the leaning is more towards a fuller IS-19 project being a low priority. Also bear in mind that we have said repeatedly with the agenda consultation, we have limited capacity to take on new projects. So I can already tell you that there are other projects that are coming up as higher priorities compared to IS-19. And then the other data point is that although we didn't specifically ask the question of what do you think about this particular project, each project on the work plan, should we continue or stop, some people did volunteer additional perspectives. There were seven respondents who commented on this particular project. Two expressed views in favor of continuing the project. The remaining five questioned whether we should continue it, and the reasons were observing that it's a lower priority than the other projects at the moment, and consistent with some of you have been saying that it's unlikely to resolve the issue without a more comprehensive project on IS-19.
Thank you, Nelly. I thought that it would be helpful to just get an indicative snapshot, at least, to see where we are, noting yours and Sue's comments that this is not a beauty contest. Where I am is probably very similar to Bruce's point, that I'm sitting on the fence and could associate myself with either direction. I hear the criticisms, and I acknowledge those and appreciate those. On the other hand, I'm also fearful of sunk cost that we will have incurred. I mean, like Tom, I think a lot of work has gone into this project. Staff have delivered an answer that seems to be bulletproof, not on the conceptual front, and we all know this, but in terms of addressing an identified problem in a very robust way. And I tend to be with Bruce that, for me, it would improve reporting, actually, because it doesn't make sense to show the assets a different amount than the liability. From a purely pragmatic perspective, having listened to this debate, even if I put myself probably more into the camp of Jin Zhao, Bruce, Tom, and Anne, we need 8 affirmative votes to get an exposure draft over the line. And I don't think that we will have that sufficient number of board members. So this is why I will call the vote for the staff recommendation and question one, to just get a clear slate that if this board decides not to take on this particular project, I just want to reiterate 2 points that I have heard people consistently saying. And we'll start with Tom's comment and saying we should really have a very good feedback statement as to what has been asked of staff, what has been done. so that if at a later stage we or a successor board decides to continue this project, they wouldn't start from scratch but could actually pull from the rack, as Tom has said. The second point is, this is not a definitive no in the sense that we will never look at this again, because we reserve the authority to make a decision about a more holistic project as part of our agenda consultation and work plan. So I think we should keep that in mind. That said, can I see a show of hands who would agree with the staff recommendation in pursuing this project, continuing this project?
Five.
So that is clear. There is a majority that would not support this. So do we then agree with the staff recommendation in question two to stop the research project and consider any further work as part of the agenda consultation? Could I see a show of hands?
12.
Okay. Thank you. With that, I circle it back to Filippo, at least saying thank you very much for the hard work that you've done. It is probably a bit depressing if you've put so much effort in it. At least what we've heard is that accountants have a true favour for worked examples and spreadsheets, especially if they lead to conclusive numbers. But I think there's little chance that we can actually bring this over the finishing line. So thank you very much, nonetheless, for all the hard work that you've done. Okay. We would now have a short break of 15 minutes before we continue with our discussion on the taxonomy and the PFS project. So could we reconvene at 22, please? 22:11.